Good evening and welcome to the Saturday evening reading at Poetry in Aldeburgh. My name is Tamar Yosilov and I'm very pleased to be introducing two poets who are fellow countrymen and another poet who has made her home in America. What I'm going to do is introduce the poets individually and then invite them to come up. I'll start by introducing Carmen Bugan. Carmen was born in Romania and emigrated to the United States in 1989. Her books include the memoir Bearing the Typewriter, Childhood Under the Eye of the Secret Police, which received the Breadloaf Conference Bakeless Prize for nonfiction, was a finalist in the George Orwell Prize for political writing, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Her previous collections are Releasing the Porcelain Birds, The House of Straw, and Crossing the Carpathians. She was also the author of Seamus Heaney and East European Poetry in Translation, Poetics of Exile. Her new book, Lilies from America, New and Selected Poems, was published earlier in the year by Shearsman and was a PBS Autumn 2019 special commendation. Carmen's poetry is intensely personal but also universal. Considering how to find a language for exile and belonging, what it is to live in a place of political oppression, and how the human spirit rises above such restrictions. Seamus Heaney has said of her work, "You succeed in doing what Wordsworth said he wanted to do, to keep the reader in the presence of flesh and blood." Extraordinary comment from Heaney. And I read with Carmen earlier in the week, and so I know you're in for a tremendous reading. Please join me in welcoming Carmen Bugan.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. And tonight's readings of the poems, tonight's reading happens to take place on the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. So the poems which I'm going to read tonight will talk about the power of words to enslave people and the power of words to release people from oppression, a power that I witnessed behind the Iron Curtain. But I'd like to thank Robin Boyd and Paul Stephenson for inviting me here, and all of you for being here tonight. In the silent country, when the hands climbed the tree to sleep, and the dog was let loose in the yard. When their children went to bed, she covered the windows in the doors with towels and hung the yellow blanket over the curtain rod. He went outside, around the farthest corner of the house, dug the typewriter from its hole, then from the garage brought a stack of papers hidden behind tools in a box. They locked the room. Both sat at the large oak table and put on gloves to hide fingerprints. Each night, one by one, hundreds of pages darkened with communal demands: hot water, electricity, freedom of speech, freedom to worship, freedom to assemble. Their arms smelled of fresh ink. The room was the sound of struck keys between two breaths. Not one star looked inside, but the wind joined the hush of shuffled paper. Before the rooster broke the news of dawn, he put the typewriter in its white crate and buried it in the ground at the back of the house. She stacked the leaflets in boxes with beans on top, same beans for months, wrinkled and dry like old thumbs. With the towels back in a closet and the blanket down, the room returned to order, quiet and dark like the street. They kissed the children in their sleep. Posing as farmers, they left for distant towns where he filled mailboxes while she watched for informers and police. Hues of mornings changed with seasons, but the early sun spilled light over his face, over her hand holding the map. At times, when they stopped to wash out the sleep with cold water, he could see the dark of her eyes. Fists met at the market and in the store. Churches were demolished, and no one said a word. Those waiting in eternal lines, or those who saw the crosses kneel in the rubble of saints in chalices. When they slept, words rose from the stacks, and they breathed them as they wore on paper. Hot water, electricity, freedom of speech, freedom to worship, freedom to assemble. They retraced in dreams each step. Typewriter in the ground, paper behind the tools, gloves in a cupboard, the dark entryways where the words went, someone looking at them through a crack in a door. Every night, the words replaced them. Her pale skin, her long brown hair. They whispered into the sleep of others in the silent country. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Father repeats his own name aloud as if to remember it. Sheepskin coat, bloodshot eyes, one suitcase. He carries his age and his language on his tongue. Mother gathers us around her. I still see on her face the green lights on a platform in Bucharest, the arm of the conductor lifting to go. When we crossed the frontier, we drank quietly from a flask of plum brandy. I still don't know what each of us was thinking. Someone carries a sign with our name written on it. We don't know him, but embrace him and let him drive us through driving snow. Visiting the country of my birth. The tyrant and his wife were exhumed for proper burial. It is 20 years since they were shot against the wall in Christmas snow. The fish in the Black Sea are dead. Waves some roll them to the beach. Tractors comb the sand. We stand at water's edge, whispering, glassy-eyed, throats parched from heat. Stray dogs howl through nights like choirs of mutilated angels, circle around us on hill paths, outside gas stations, shops, streets, in parking lots. Farther into wilderness, we slow down where horse and foal walk home to the clay hut by themselves. Cows cross roads in evenings alone, bells clinking. People sit on wooden benches in front of their houses, counting hours until darkness, while shadows of mountains caress their heads. On through hot dust of open plain to my village. A toothless man from 20 years ago asks for money, says he used to work for us. I am searching for prints of mare's hooves in our yard, between stable and kitchen window, now gone with the time my 2 feet used to fit inside one hoof. We sit down to eat on a porch when 2 sparrows come flying in circles over the table, low and fast, happily. My grandparents' souls, I think aloud. But my cousin says, no. The sparrows have nested under eaves. Look past the garden. nests big as cupped hands, twigs and straw, bird songs skids in the air above us. Into still remaining rooms, no sewing machine or old furniture with sculpted flowers on walnut wood, no rose bushes climbing windowsills outside. And here, our water well, a vase of cracked cement, past ghosts of lilac, pear, and quince, in a sun-bitten yard, I step on reimagined hooves, pull the chain, smell wet rust. Unblemished sky ripples inside the tin bucket, cradled in my arms the way I used to hold warm goose eggs close to skin so not to break them. The earth will remember you, my grandparents once said. Here, where such dreams do not come true, I have come to find hoof prints as well as signs from sparrows. The names of things. Sunlight in a water bowl on a doorstep, then on a pond far from home. Soarele. Fire in the terracotta hearth, then in a pit outside a tent thousands of miles away. Focul. My black sea lolling the shore, then dreams of sea, waking cheeks with stinging salt. Mara. Air encircling the grapes outside the window, then gliding with a parachute above a heron. Aerul. Soil exhaling after rain through gaps between cherry leaves, then crying dirty tears from roots of a fallen birch. Pamântul. I went with my father and with my mother in 2013 to visit all the prisons where he was tortured. He spent 12 years in a series of prisons and labor camps for his various protests against the government. And in one of the prisons, I saw writing on the walls and the marks, the grooves that the chains have left in the cement on the floor. And it was very powerful to be there with my dad, who was good and healthy and indulged me in this because I really wanted to know what it was like inside there. We spent years waiting for him on the other side of those prison doors and windows. So I wanted him to take me inside there before he died. And then I wrote this poem called The Prisoner Scribe's Allowance. Walls are manuscripts and finished books, illuminated with what the poet found in his cell. Words of prayer snagged around the throats of rats, weaving the soul with a spider's net, working its way in the darkness by the boarded window that only serves to remind him of the sky and air he could not let himself dream for. Beware the dreams inside those rooms. They spring at you for a clean kill. Punishment must be like this, my father said. After all, you tried to change a country. Don't dream in there. The guards do not give the prisoner scribe a pen. That would turn the scribe into a man. He is left alone with the walls. But what reaches those walls? The souls of others spilled out on their cement face, their ghosts dancing in the shadows of the scribe's mind, material for books, 4 canvases wide open and 45 kilograms of chains to turn into writing instruments. The rust, the dried blood, here's the ink. He chooses the wall by the invisible window and begins to write with the links of the chains, moving his body around, etching the letters into the cement until the first line comes out. Our Father, who art in heaven. He looks at his work. He has written over someone else's lines. He writes between another's lines, "Hallowed be thy name." And beside another's, "Thy kingdom come." Then he illuminates the manuscript. Now his nail is the pen, ink, the blood on his knuckle. He is instrument. And I'll end with 2 short poems for my children, because it's not all like that, you know? This is a poem that I wrote for my son when he first learned how to read. We are living in France at the time. Through the village streets for Stefano. All of the sudden, it seems you read. The street sign that we passed by all those years ago today says in your boy's voice, "Fin des empreintes, bref someone." Our street opens up to you the right of ways. Your hand is nearly as big as mine now. We exchange gloves to mock the winter wind, and you leave messages for me, written in letters that straggle off the words like children standing in a crooked line. You read what I write, a hurried letter, "Dear Lucy," stealing that silence from me when I am alone with the paper. Suddenly it seems you read, and I remember your first smile drunk in breast milk, the moment when you looked into my eyes, the first time when you recognized me in the crowd, that one day you laughed for the first time because something was funny, and we wrote it down so you can find it later when you're grown. But now you read, and with you, I take all words as true. And of course, my daughter would be very jealous if I didn't read the poem for her. This is called "Waterways" for Alisa, who shouted, "Mommy, I keep losing your steps." This is on a walk on a beach in Long Island. The water is writing on sand many drafts of the same story, one more shimmering than the next. I go there to memorize their turns and feel their calling power, wrestle with their yeses and whys. I get involved, make footsteps on some pages. The ocean erases them impatiently, offering shells the size of my feet. "Shh," it says, "now listen." My daughter says the clouds try to bloom above the water, white hydrangeas, but the water pulls them down. "Clouds are children of the water," I say. "It's hard to let go of children." Under the bridge this morning, the river passes for a mirror, half fogged over. Visions and revisions touch its surface as we look on. "Mommy," my child says, "the clouds caress the water." A white hawk appears above us, held up by the warm breath of the earth. The tips of its wings recall silver lining, gliding out the view like a thought hard to hold. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen, for that powerful and moving reading. I next want to introduce Joshua Weiner, who is the poetry editor of Tikkun magazine and professor of English at the University of Maryland. He is a recipient of the Rome Prize in Literature from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. His first collection was The World's Room, followed by From the Book of Giants. He is also the editor of a book of essays at The Barriers on the Poetry of Tom Gunn. His most recent collection is The Figure of a Man Being Swallowed by a Fish, which was published in 2013. And he has a prose book about the refugee crisis in Europe entitled Berlin Notebook, Where Are the Refugees? After Trump's election, he started writing poems in Trump's voice, which has led to a virtual chapbook, Everything I do good, Trumpisms. It would be great if he read one or two of those tonight. And he's working at the moment on a translation of the German writer Nelly Sachs. Joshua's poems often start with astute observations on objects or histories and build a complex imaginative world around them, resulting in extended meditations, an exploration, to borrow one of his own lines, on the everyday momentum of the world. Please welcome Joshua Weiner.
Thank you for that introduction. And thanks to Poetry in Albro and to Paul and Robin, all the volunteers. This is not an easy thing to pull off, and it's going great. I'm going to read a few poems from the book that Tammy mentioned, The Figure of a Man Being Swallowed by a Fish, and then end with some new poems, too. The first one's the title poem, and it takes the title of an object in the permanent collection at the Baltimore Museum of Art in Maryland. It's a small sculpture. It's very ugly, but very charismatic, of a fish standing upright on its tail. And out of its mouth is a man who is rising. We don't know who named the sculpture The Figure of a Man Being Swallowed by a Fish. No one knows who made it, or when, or where it was made. But the more that I looked at it, the less it looked like the figure of a man being swallowed by a fish. The figure of a man being swallowed by a fish is not a man being swallowed by a fish. With eyes like 8-point throwing stars, it's a man being swallowed by a war, a man being taken into the mouth of a woman or being swallowed by his work. It's a man traveling far inside a book, a man being swallowed up in smoke. He swallows the smoke that blends around him like a thought. It's a man being swallowed by a sound. He shapes it so he lives inside a song. Of a man being swallowed by his kin, his skin. A man being swallowed by the state. Leviathan in 1948. It's a man being swallowed by another man, literally eaten as a pathway to God. It's a man being swallowed by a sight he cannot reach, cannot touch, cannot trace. It's a man who won't recognize his face, who can't fit the parts or find the place. It's a man in triumph over death, who laughs and beats the dust from his clothes, a man tasting dust inside the laugh. It's a man who listens to the clock, a man with nothing to exchange, a rude man, his twin he leaves behind. It's a man who wants to be a bride. A man being swallowed by his fault, with something old to show and new to hide. It's a man who tries to haul the rope. A man who stooping can't provide. A man who can't forget his name. It's a man who doesn't know his worth. It's a man being swallowed by his wrath, his youth, yield, luck, the law, his fear, the fog, his fame. It's a man being swallowed by a coat, his father's coat. He smells of the fit. A man being swallowed by his vows. It's a man softly squeezing for the vein. He never finds it. He's minding the road. It's a man being swallowed by a room in which he finds a man being swallowed by a fish. It's a man who thinks, what's in a man who exits into night at closing time? The figure of a man being swallowed by a fish. I really enjoyed the prose poem lecture this afternoon with Jeremy and Noel Todd, and liked very much one of the comments he made that the prose poem, we feel like it's pulling away somehow from the lyric. I thought I'd read this prose poem. If you are traveling and you stop in a hotel, you might find a brochure or a pamphlet in your room that says, things to do while you're here. Things to do while you're here. I was at Disney World by myself. How long had I been there? Surrounded but without companion. The rides did not look fun. When I ran into a Disney character on the street, I felt uneasy. There's Pluto, mute, unnaturally upright and intrepid on his two hind feet, a wide, happy dog smile cut into the snout. From tip of black nose bulb to saucer-sized black pupil looked the length of a torso. Could I make out the sweating human body inside the heavy plush construction? Hardly a costume, the cramping box of the little ease. And if I had a knife, would I wrestle him down and liberate the body from its gainful employment? I wandered aimlessly from Frontierland to Tomorrowland to Liberty Square, eating Disney food and looking for a chair away from the crowd where I could sit and read the book I was carrying. I found myself again in a busy picnic area. Its dishevelment unsettled my nerves. I found an open bench, sat down, and opened the book on the long wooden table. Soon I was lost in a sentence, a cadence. My physical surroundings became a faint background to my book. The world slowed down. I was content, without worry. The sun was making the pages warm and crinkly. Old pages. My elbows on the wood were not unpleasantly hot. Even as the wood got hotter, it was not unpleasant. But the brightness was making me dizzy. Something made me look up. Dogs were surrounding me in a circle, six of them. With eye contact, the six dogs began a low growling. Their heads lowered, napes bristling, coarse-haired, scrawny. I could count their ribs. They were baring their teeth, their ulcerated gums. Something was wrong with them. Parts of their bodies had been shaved. Patches of scaly gray skin showed stitches. Had they been subjected to experiments? With a step toward me, the circle was tightening. Can someone please help me? These dogs are going to hurt me. I was standing up, speaking out loud. Can someone please help me, please? The sun was blinding in the blue sky. It was burning my neck. No one paid attention. They were all outside the circle of dogs. But here's my friend Jonathan, inside the closing circle. When did he appear? The circle was slowly closing. Had he been there all along? In a calm voice, he was explaining something. His voice had a quiet authority, a softness and firmness I could hear before I made out the words he was saying. The problem is time. The problem is you can't stop it. A subtle shadow passed over his face. The skin was drawn back from his mouth a little. He was slowly but visibly aging as he spoke. Now he looked younger, now older. Age ebbed in his face like tidal water. It's not a special problem. It's a problem for everyone. He was studying the dogs. But you can shape it. He turned from the dogs to the spires of the Magic Kingdom, its color and clamor. Vanilla and frying oil fragranced the air, mixing with the smell of hot garbage. He turned back to the closing circle of dogs. This is your nightmare, but you can do something with it. And for what seemed a long time, I chose not to wake up. This is maybe a poem about waking up. I was talking with the poet Catherine Maris, who was telling me about work she's doing, critical work on the psychological structure of narcissism in contemporary poetry. I said, like, well, who do you leave out? You know? Well, this one's for her. It's called Narcissus Leaves the Pool. How long did I kneel there, beckoned by that other one who held me in my place, reflecting back my face, witnessing affection, staring into my stare? Oblivious to all, I harbored no regret. They were hard and sharp as stone who left me there alone, transfixed and yet transported through a channel. Though what I could discern, caught inside that circuit, dried and browned, and curled into a barren world with no one else in it and nothing more to learn. And I, in my obsession, faded, began to shrink like a clenched flower whose head bends lower, lower, as if to drink in my possession. Now the sweetness of that spring can't quench, and what I thirst is the clear deepening difference of a different cadence I couldn't hear at first, so tuned to my own singing. How did I let her go, my sister, who is me and not me all the same, though we may share a name, even when we can't see who's above and who's below, how shadow mirrors shadow. But when a falling leaf troubled the glass, and passing through the impasse, keeping me from grief I didn't want to know. Still, it tried to stay afloat, that former love that formed another life like a cry inside a laugh. But I had had enough of echo. I turned away. I turned as to allow myself to turn again, lost in wind and rain, peppering steps into the green that promises no end. Even as I stumble to find a new direction in branches latticework and roots entanglement, to follow where they went, like a sentence in a book, twisting past perfection that one can almost read, that I could almost say aloud as to another, if only I went further, like nighttime into day, sunlight into shade. This one's in the voice of a woman who's about the age of my mother. She's a painter, and her second husband has recently died. It's called A Painter on Their Anniversary. My first painting, that one, I remember the feeling that the light was creating the shade somehow, of coming into November, of always turning, never waiting. But I've always been waiting, remembering. I remember his hands, kind of clumsy, soft, strong as faith. And I knew no one would turn me like that again. But then I find I'm alone and waiting for someone. Two sons, though, they remember, but then they forget. What I remember, I turn to paint to call it back. And what I see, it's knowing myself. It's less than enough. It's more than was said. But I'm waiting for someone to remember me. And my second husband just died. He just died. I'm sorting it through. So many tokens like dusty leaves in a dry pot. So much predates me. Just stories I know or partly remember. I'd love to replant, but where? The soil is blowing away. No container, loose particles. He knew how to save them. Not a plant perished, if he had a say. Turned brown to green. He'd wait for it to grow before finding a new place inside or out. New places. They remind me where I've been. But where I want to go? It's not anywhere special. It's where I'm asked in. I had a rare red collie who loved the rain. Never came in, except for thunder. She understood. She knew my name. When mother called me, she'd answer. When she didn't come back, she didn't come back. And my worst fear is what I feared. She finds me in sleep. Still does. She licks my neck. So in every canvas, there's a little red. Another friend turned on herself. She left me the ring I could never wear. How she wore me out with her infectious laugh when we played together at solitaire. But to win these marks, my age, you rest on a bed of shards. Each memory is a cut, too many notches. I'm scarred, but what I remember and can't forget. I'm always trying to get it right, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield, to find how shadow yields to light, how a dark sky turns a yellow field. My sons, though, I envy what they don't remember. But some corners can't be turned, it's all wall, until I find that doorway each November, waiting for someone to call me through it, to welcome me. It's your turn to be remembered. We didn't forget you. You lived for us, so we learned your memories. How I waited, wishing it were true, wishing it didn't matter, but it does. Like light, it adds nothing except itself to be remembered, to be the sound and source of love. I'm waiting for someone to remember me. We were talking last night in the cottage, Greg Pardlow and Catherine and Phil Hancock, about translation. I thought I would read this. I call it a version. It's a kind of translation or imitation of a poem by Nazim Hikmet, the great Turkish poet who wrote many of his poems while imprisoned for his political views. He was a communist. The poem's untitled, but for practical purposes, I've titled it Hikmet Çankırı Prison, 1938, a version. Today is Sunday. Today, for the first time, they let me go out into the sun. And I stood there. I didn't move. Struck for the first time, the very first time ever. How far away from me the sky is. How blue it is. How wide. I sat down in respect, in awe. I sat down on the ground. I leaned my back against the wall. In this moment, there were no waves to fall into. In this moment, there was no liberty and no wife, my wife. There was only the earth beneath me, the sun above me, and me. And how I am grateful. I am happy to have this thing I call my life. I'm going to end with a recent poem about a friend of mine who died recently, one of the great citizens of London. He took the form of an enormous dog. He was an enigmatic creature, and the one thing we all knew about him was he was no dog. It's called Who is Bash? Who is Bash? Throughout the house, melodious presence, he moves without a sound. He is not cat, not bird, not fish, not pig, not rat. Who is Bash? Even when you're standing, he can lick flug from your navel, waiting for a phone call, waiting for an egg, waiting for a kettle, waiting for a cab, waiting for Bash to say something, finally, with his mouth big as an oven. Who is Bash? When you hear him, his one word in the morning, his one word at night when he must go out, does he ever need to go out? Who is Bash when he comes back in? When he's done outside, when he smells good things, when he comes back in, when you're not there, at the bottom of the road, at the very end of Portobello Road. He touches you with all his body, giving commands, dropping his head down into your lap. Who is Bash? Not stag beetle, not mink, not skua, not demoiselle, not jackdaw, not natterjack. Who is Bash throughout the house? Melodious presence, he moves without sound. Through tansy, through tall melilote, through laburnum, through lady's smock. Not kittywake, not keeled skimmer, not wolf spider, not willow tit, hiding in the mallow. Where is Bash? Rinpoche and quiet, citizen of the kitchen, with mouth like an oven, who never talked while eating. Where has he gone? What will he bring? What will be the question? Thank you.
Thank you, Josh, for that reading. Those poems open surprising and extraordinary vistas. Our final poet this evening is Gregory Pardlow. His first collection, Totem, won the APR Honickman First Book Prize, and his most recent, Digest, which was published in 2014, is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. The Pulitzer judges mentioned Pardlow's clear-voiced poems that bring readers the news from 21st century America, rich with thought, ideas, and histories public and private. He is also the author of Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America, an exploration of blackness and masculinity in American culture. He is poetry editor for the Virginia Quarterly Review and teaches in the MFA program at Rutgers University. The poems in Digest are at once tough and lyrical, plain-speaking, but intricate in their critique of the current political climate in America. The U.S. laureate Tracy K. Smith praises Pardlow for his courageous social conscience and his mighty voice. Please join me in welcoming Gregory Pardlow.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks, Josh and Carmen. Those fantastic readings. Thank you, Paul and Robin, Catherine, for being a poetry matchmaker. I was a little confused when I first got here for the, you know, probably the first 24 hours, I was wondering what poetry festival everyone was referring to, because I was attending the Aldeburgh Festival, and everybody kept pronouncing it weird. It's like they don't know where they are. These strange people. So I'll just read a couple of poems from the book. And if you would indulge me, I want to read you some new poems that are so, you know, I know I hate when people do this, but they're all scribbled on, and I'm still trying to work them out. But I promise they don't, I don't know if I can make that promise. I was going to say I promise they don't suck. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Slave narratives. So slave narratives all begin with the same three words, I was born, and what else do you want to know? When they were escaping, I read that escaping slaves would fill their pockets with coffee grounds and eggshells to throw the scent off, and they would sprinkle it. This is called Written by Himself. I was born in minutes in a roadside kitchen, a skillet whispering my name. I was born to rainwater and lie. I was born across the river where I was borrowed with clothespins, a harrow tooth, broadsides sewn in my shoes. I returned, though it please you, through no fault of my own, pockets filled with coffee grounds and eggshells. I was born still and superstitious. I bore an unexpected burden. I gave birth, I gave blessing, I gave rise to suspicion. I was born abandoned, outdoors in the heat-shaped air, air drifting like spirits and old windows. I was born a fraction and a cipher and a ledger entry. I was an index of first lines when I was born. I was born waist deep, stubborn in the water, crying, ain't I a woman and a brother? I was born to this hall of mirrors, this horror story. I was born with a prologue of references, pursued by mosquitoes and thieves. I was born passing off the problem of the 20th century. I was born. I read minds before I could read fishes and loaves. I walked a piece of the way alone before I was born. Stuff I'm working on now, I've gotten really curious about, I'm sure it's a sign of my age, but I've gotten really curious about faith and, if there is an afterlife, would I be totally screwed? So I'm writing these poems that kind of think about faith and fidelity. A couple things I want to say. Some of you might remember there was a wrestler named Owen Hart in 1999 who was doing this stunt, and the idea was he was going to be lowered down from the rooftop of the stadium into the ring, and something went wrong, and obviously, and he fell to his death. And you know, the thing about wrestling is it's quasi-performative, right? You don't know the difference between what's real and what's not. So I was really fascinated by this moment of believing, not believing. One, pratfalling from rafters in a Kansas City stadium, Owen Hart wrestled cables and angels for 78 feet and left his fans in ecstatic suspense like a hypnotist dropped dead before snapping his fingers. You may recall the children's tremulous cheers as his body flopped like a rabbit's ear at their feet. Their belief he would rise again, not reborn, but like Teresa, whom sister mendicants feared might float away, lit with the spirit like a jack-o'-lantern. And so they'd throw a James Brown cape over that weightless saint whenever she signaled her miracle move, chanting, please, in the collar's faux fur, then proceed to channel a canticle while riding the Holy Ghost like a ping pong ball on a hairdryer. Wrestlers call this kayfabe, with a hummingbird's commitment to the illusion of flight. A wrestler stays faithful to the mask and promises to drop at the laying on of hands. Until I surrendered to a higher principle, I threw knives. I was the target. And still, I longed to feel my back pierced with hooks, to hear the cold pinch and chatter as I'm cranked toward stadium lights. My mother believes it was all a show, not a disease as sure as gravity, but a phase, like the rainbow suspenders I wore in third grade. Did the flying Walendas believe in the rope or in each other's belief in the rope? My brother is drinking again. This time, Mom's footing his visits to a hypnotist. It's not easy for him, she defended, like it was for you. Oh, greatest of ease. Oh, routine enabler. I weary on my spacewalk of doubt. Dearly beloved, by heart, I know only the serenity prayer and the intro to Let's Go Crazy. I hear them both, their magnetic airs. They beckon like an empty trapeze in the dark. You may know, I was a surprise to me, or it was something new to me. LARP is live action role play. I think that's all you need to know over this one. LARP sex sounds spectacular. But have you heard of sex between avatars? In 18th century France, Franz Mesmer made friends dance in sync like iron filings under magnetized tips of his Mesmer fingers until further experiments proved to move the crowd he need only use his Mesmer eyes. Ancients believed our eyes project spittle-like rays of light connecting to their object's essence in a process not unlike intercourse. Others say there's a tiny ship's captain ensconced in a capsule of doubt at my body's helm in a theory called extromission, where sight leaves my eye to roam, a prodigal avatar on an erotic pilgrimage, carrying with it all of the ethical baggage we can heap on a ghost. Where would everyone's avatars convene for their clandestine bacchanals, but in the dreamtime world Aborigines call everywhere? If Jesus says looking lustfully at people is as good as the deed, aren't we responsible for our crimes at sea? Is it possible to have a nocturnal extramission? Or to inhabit the world not deceitfully, just not sincerely? Bad faith players in virtual worlds are said to be griefers. I hear the word and picture a white kid in blackface. Should one confess to have griefed the system, or is that even a crime these days? These days of other-oriented narcissism, These days of other-oriented narcissism like writing memoir as fan fiction. Dear Joni, you said love is touching souls. If I were to reach out to yours now in extra mission, would you register that singularity in the cosmos of your affection? Would you feel my soul hypothetically touching yours just as surely as you've touched mine? Bud-sized flames, popsicle the wicks of a wax 1 and 5 on top. Dominican cakes. In Brooklyn, we have the Dominican cakes made by the Dominican bakers from the Dominican Republic are like really gooey. Do you guys have Dominican cakes here? No. Okay, they're fantastic. So we get Dominican cakes for just about every whatever excuse we can come up with. Bud-sized flames popsicle the wicks of a wax 1 and 5 on top of a Dominican cake. With tango arms, we hold the wedding knife, renew the annual jibes. Everyone's left the asylum, no point escaping now. Our marriage is old enough to get a job. Is it devotion or inertia keeps us together? Why split hairs? After a gut reno of the labyrinth, new plumbing in the hedgerows, we've Stockholmed ourselves to beds of roses. Our eyes twinkle with the love that moves that lone cart to wander the empty parking lot. Stumble-wheeled comfort pet, you get us to the register. I confess, I tried to replace the family rabbit because I couldn't bear to see it die. Isn't love, why split hairs? A kind of fit, you get it? Hairs, all right, anyway. Why split hairs, a kind of fear? Isn't love a kind of fear? I fantasize, before our mingled breath exhausts the candle, an undiscovered race of composite hominids, each one smizing dolefully as the scroll speed increases, smearing every face back into the one the bakery has airbrushed next to mine across this moist and delectable confection we now jab at each other's faces, fork by fork. Bathing in the milk light of the boob tube in a house that moved like a submarine, I wormed my finger down the back of my jammies to see what the fuss was about. For once, my dad's asthma didn't announce him like Darth Vader emerging from the dark corridor. When he appeared, the moment flashbulbed onto a scalloped-edged memory. I left my body, rotten as it was, and saw that boy on the floor watching TV with his finger in his ass. I tossed the shame potato to my dad and rigged that perspective into place, camera embedded in the figurative potato, him to me and back, shaping a collective disgrace that we could share, loopy carousel music forever rising in my ears, my face at the center of a Hitchcock spiral. Dear Lord, Vader, I am afraid my father is still trapped in that galley, egg-eyed and barnacled and too mortified to eat. Ten. My father, Bacchus, wanted a daughter instead of me. He felt the threat a son implies and took you, my infant virility, scarf skin like a halo, angel of my innocence, four-fledged. Before I knew myself, I knew guilt. You were vestigial as the divot where the angel pinched my lips in binding silence. Would I see myself in style or fit if I encountered you, my soul draped on a fence post? You must be tattered like a moth-eaten turtleneck by now, hood like the hood of a headsman. If you were re-appended, would you lisp like chiffon or crunch like corduroy? You are the macho my father's dream foretold, he who, in the end, was like a son to me, whose own member circumscribed a foreshortened life story mine was intended to resemble. My forebear, the brutal gardener. He who conjured the corona must have foreseen his own eclipse and standing on ceremony found at hand a means to get my sex to bleed. 11. The swear jar isn't empty. Full of flowers instead of coins, it makes a cursed bouquet of love-me-nots. A tangled vine of credit extended to one most likely to default. Such a trifling bargain, flowers for mercy. Oh, nature, predatory lender. Risk is the commuter bus I ride between damnation and wonder. Stitch my wounds loosely. Give me chastity, O Lord, says the Berber saint. For miracle and sin are kindred. Each is hatched from a broken law. 2 dad poems. That's a couple more dad poems. Convertible. My pop let me steer when I was small enough to snug between his belly and the wheel. Any random intersection, he might hoist me across the handbrake and onto his lap, to pilot the wagon before returning me to earth. As I got older, he'd make me steer while he lit a smoke or shed his jacket. His ashes arrived in a cardboard carton with shipping labels and barcode, heavy enough to trigger the seatbelt alarm as we clipped home, honeysuckle in the air, from the post office. A reasonable person would have put the box on the floor, but you know already, don't you? I held him in my lap. "You're mine," I told the box of dad dust, lifting my hands occasionally, reckless to the wind, tempting the evening, swinging our private chariot of steel and bone. Metaphor. Two-poem warning. Metaphor. It means to transfer or carry, as a man might carry his namesake in his arms or on his shoulders, cheering, "We bad, we bad," as my father did when he saw himself in me. As I came of age, however, I thought my father was, in the sense that means to hamper or impede, an embarrassment, which is, as all languages essentially, a metaphor. I.A. Richards says a metaphor consists of a tenor and a vehicle. My father would point out that he's using a metaphor to define metaphors. A literalization, like when Richards asks himself if a wooden leg is a metaphor for a wooden leg. My dad, Gregory Pardlow Sr., before he died, lost his leg to diabetes. Even though he himself would be the only person to see it, he insisted that the prosthesis match his skin tone. This is the same guy who gave me a Hot Wheels car for Christmas. A joke, see? He promised me a car when I turned 16. It shimmers on my desk now, a kitschy muse with shark's teeth decals behind the wheel wells. Before he died, I told him, I would have preferred a matchbox car packaged in an actual matchbox, literalizing the figurative commingling of tenor and vehicle, more metonym than metaphor, a pedigree, in other words. He told me to get the stick out of my ass. Greg Pardlow is dead. Long live Greg Pardlow. And I'll wrap up with this one, Wishing Well. It's all in poem. Wishing Well. Outside the Met, a man walks up, sun tweaking the brim sticker on his baseball cap, and he says, "Pardon me, old school," he says. "You know, is this a wishing well?" "Yeah, son," I say sideways over my shrug. "Throw your bread on the water." I tighten my chest, wheezy as Rockaway Beach sand, with a pull of faux smoke from my e-cig to cozy the truculence I hotbox alone, and I am at the museum because it is not a bar. Because he appears not to have changed them in days, I eye the heel-chewed hems of his pants and think probably he will ask me for 50 cents any minute now. Wait for it. A smoke or something. Central Park displays the frisking transparency of autumn, tracing paper sky. Leaves like eraser crumbs gum the pavement. As if deciphering celestial script, I squint and purse off toward the roofline of the museum, aloof as he fists two pennies from his pockets, mumbling and then aloud, "My man," he says, "hey, my man, I'm gonna make a wish for you too." I'm laughing now, "So what, you want me to sign a waiver?" He laughs along, "Ain't say all that," he says, "but you do have to hold my hand and close your eyes." I make a starless night of my face before he asks, "Are you ready?" "Yeah, dog, I'm ready." "Sure, sure, let's do this." His rough hand inflates in mine like a blood pressure cuff, and I squeeze back as if we are about to step together from the sill of all resentment and timeless toward the dream source of unneeding. The two of us hurtle, sharing the cosmic breast of plenitude. When I hear the coins blink against the surface and I cough up daylight like I've just been dragged ashore. See now, you'll never walk alone, he jokes, and is about to hand me back to the day he found me in like I was a rubber duck. And he says, you got to let go. But I feel bottomless, and I know he means well, though I don't believe, and I feel myself shaking my head no when he means let go his hand. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Greg, for the amazing variety of that reading, from avatars to Dominican cakes to the legacy of fathers. I just want to point out to you that there are books behind us. All three of our poets tonight have books on sale. Please go have a look. Get them to sign copies. This is your chance. And please join me in thanking again Greg, Josh, and Carmen.